That left them dangling, Woodward said. Stoner said he sympathized with their precarious position. Woodward couldn't argue with that. There was nothing left to say. Both reporters were losing their composure. Woodward couldn't contact Deep Throat until that night at the earliest. Bernstein couldn't reach Sloan. The whole office was in limbo. A pall had descended over the newsroom. Other reporters watched silently as the tension built. Bradley and Simons occasionally came out of their offices to tell the reporters to stay cool, touch all bases. Sussman looked agonized. Rosenfeld kept shuffling between his office and the reporters' desks, demanding to be kept informed of every nuance as they backtracked their conversations with the sources. At 3 p.m., Bernstein and Woodward left the office to find the FBI agent who had confirmed the Haldeman story two nights before. They found him in a corridor outside his office. Bernstein approached him and attempted to ask if the reporters had misunderstood. "I'm not talking to you," the agent said, backing away. Bernstein moved toward him as the agent backpedaled in the corridor. Inexplicably, the agent seemed to be smiling. "This was no fucking joke," Bernstein told him. The agent turned and walked quickly to the end of the corridor, then turned down another. Bernstein and Woodward had already determined their course of action. If the agent didn't stand by his remarks, they were going to talk to his boss and demand an explanation. It now seemed clear that Sloan had not told either the FBI or the grand jury about Haldeman. Bernstein waited a moment, then ran after the agent and cornered him in the hallway. "This was deadly serious business," he told him, "not some G-man version of hide-and-seek. They wanted some answers, immediately." Woodward walked up and joined the discussion. He was holding a folded copy of notes typed from Bernstein's conversation with the agent. It was time for some straight answers, or the matter would be taken up with his boss, Woodward told the agent. The agent was no longer smiling. He looked panicked. "What the hell are you talking about?" he said. "I'll deny everything. I'll deny everything." Woodward unfolded his copy of the notes and showed them to the agent. "They didn't want to get anyone in trouble," he said. "They just needed to know that what, if any, error had been made. And they needed to know that minute." "I'm not talking to you about Haldeman or anything else," the agent said. "I can't even be seen talking to you two bastards." Bernstein tried to calm him. Something had gotten screwed up, and they needed to know what. There was no reason to suspect each other of being devious or acting in bad faith. The agent was sweating. His hands were trembling. "Fuck you," he said, and walked into his office. The reporters spotted one of the agent's superiors in the hallway. Their next move represented the most difficult professional, unprofessional, really, decision either had ever made. They were going to blow a confidential source. Neither had ever done it before. Both knew instinctively that they were wrong. But they justified it. They suspected they had been set up. Their anger was reasonable. Their self-preservation was at stake, they told each other. Bernstein and Woodward walked over to the agent's superior and shook hands. The three of them needed to go somewhere and talk, Woodward said. What was the problem? The reporters told him about Bernstein's telephone conversation with the agent concerning Haldeman. Both had been on the line. Woodward showed him the typed notes. The man read them hurriedly. They could see his anger building. "You realize that it's against the law for one person to monitor a call that goes across a state line," he told them. The reporters said they would readily accept the consequences if they had violated the law. But the immediate issue was Haldeman and whether they had been wrong. The superior marched off without saying another word. In a few minutes, the agent came rushing down the hall toward the reporters. "I'm ordering you two to stay in this building," he said, pointing and waving a finger in the air. "You're not to leave." As he went racing off, Bernstein and Woodward agreed that the agent had no authority to order them to stay in the building unless he arrested them. They decided they had better call Sussman and get some advice. Woodward thought it might be a good idea to get a lawyer to join them. They walked out of the building to a payphone across the street and called Sussman. He suggested that they return to the post, observing that it was absurd that the agent should order them around. "Did he arrest you?" Sussman asked. Bernstein said no. Rosenfeld was on the line, too, calling the agent various names and saying they would teach him not to dick around with the Washington Post. The reporters decided to ignore the advice and went back to the agent's boss. Maybe there was a way to straighten it out. He was in his office. A secretary admitted them at once. The boss sat behind a large desk. The agent stood next to him. His superior ordered the agent to leave. "Now, exactly what is this all about?" he asked as the door closed. Unless they could determine the accuracy or inaccuracy of the Haldeman story, they might have to use the name of any source who had knowingly misled them. They were obliged to defend themselves. They wanted to know if the agent had purposely given them false information. More important, Bernstein said, they had to know how they had made such a mistake. They still didn't understand. Was Haldeman one of the five, or wasn't he? Had Sloan said he was, or hadn't he? They thought that their problem was not the substance of the report, but the mention of Sloan's grand jury testimony. "We're not discussing the case," the boss said. The reporters tried again. If they were wrong, a correction and an apology were required. Whom should they apologize to? What should they say? "You're getting no answers from here," the man said. Half an hour later, the reporters were in Bradley's office again, with Sussman, Rosenfeld, and Simons. "What happened?" Bradley asked, leaning over his desk and extending upturned hands toward Bernstein and Woodward. They explained that they still didn't know. Woodward observed that they had the option of naming their sources, because any agreement with a source was broken if he had given bad information. Rosenfeld was unsure. Bernstein was against it. Bradley signaled for quiet. "You're not even sure whether you've got it right or wrong." He was agitated but displayed no anger. "Suppose you name sources. They'll just deny it, and then where are you?" "Look, fellas, we don't name our sources. We're not going to start doing that." Bernstein felt relieved. Rosenfeld looked dispirited but stayed calm. He suggested going back to each one, talking with Deep Throat and Sloan and anyone else they could find. Then, in a day or two, they could see where they were. The reporters said they were virtually certain that Sloan must not have given testimony about Haldeman before the grand jury. Woodward suggested writing that much, at least, and acknowledging their error. Bradley grimaced. "You don't know where you are. You haven't got the facts. Hold your water for a while. I don't know whether we should believe Sloan's attorney even now. We're going to wait and see how this shakes out." Bradley then turned to his typewriter to write a statement for all the news organizations that had been calling that afternoon for a comment. The two-ply paper flew through his typewriter and onto the floor like a scene from a Marx Brothers movie. After a number of false starts, he issued the following statement: "We stand by our story." He was later to recall, "I issued two statements in that one year, both on Watergate. Geez, what options did I really have? By this time I was up the river with these two reporters. I can remember sitting down at the typewriter and writing about 30 statements and then sort of saying, 'Fuck it, let's go stand by our boys.'" Bernstein and Woodward sat tight and didn't do a story for the next day. But others did. Many papers which hadn't carried the Haldeman story gave prominent notice to the White House's denial. Ben Bagdikian later wrote in the Columbia Journalism Review that the first information readers of the Chicago Tribune received of the post-Haldeman story was not the morning it broke, but the next day on page 7, under the headline, "Ziegler Denounces Post-Spy Stories, Denies Link." Peter Osnos, who had recently returned to Washington from a tour as the Post's Vietnam correspondent, put together a front-page story on the statement by Sloan's attorney and the White House denial. At 8:45 p.m., Bernstein finally reached Hugh Sloan by telephone. Bernstein explained their dilemma. They realized they were in error, but they weren't sure where. Sloan was sympathetic. "The problem is that I don't agree with your conclusions as you wrote them. Haldeman had indeed controlled the fund, but the matter hadn't come up in the grand jury, right?" "Bob Haldeman's name has never come up in my interviews with the grand jury. Our denial is strictly limited to your story. It just isn't factually true. I never said it before the grand jury. I was never asked. I'm not trying to influence your pursuit of the story. The denial was strictly low-key. Purposely low-key. Sloan's message seemed clear, though not explicit. Haldeman had controlled the fund. The matter hadn't come up during his grand jury testimony. Either the reporters had misunderstood what Sloan had told them about the grand jury earlier that week, or Sloan had misinterpreted their question. The telephone conversation with Sloan was at least a hopeful sign. If the reporters could reestablish beyond any doubt that Haldeman controlled the fund and could explain the error, their credibility might not be totally destroyed. Bernstein and Woodward were exhausted. They tried to analyze the steps that had led them to such a monumental blunder. They had assumed too much. Persuaded by their sources and by their own deductions that Haldeman loomed behind Watergate, they had grasped a slim reed, the secret fund. The decision had some justification. The Nixon campaign's cash had been the tangible key that had unlocked the secret activities. But they had taken shortcuts once they had themselves come to be convinced that Haldeman controlled the fund. They had heard what they wanted to hear. The night Sloan confirmed that Haldeman was one of the five, they had not even asked whether Haldeman had exercised his authority, whether he had actually approved any payments. They hadn't asked Sloan specifically what he had been asked before the grand jury or what his response had been. Once Sloan mentioned the magic words, they had left and not called back. They had not asked him to say it again, to be sure they understood each other. In dealing with the FBI agent, they had compounded their mistakes. Bernstein's questioning had been perfunctory. He should have attempted to get the agent to mention the name himself in his own context. If the agent had failed to do so, then the confirmation route might have been acceptable. The Haldeman-Ehrlichman mix-up should have served as a warning that the agent might have been saying more than he knew. Bernstein's ruse of accusing the FBI of ineptitude in order to provoke the agent had been bad judgment. Bernstein hadn't dealt with the agent enough to know how reliable he was or how he would react. They had realized that confronting the agent's boss was unethical as soon as they had done it. They had endangered the agent's career, betrayed his trust, and risked their credibility with other sources. There were other miscalculations. Bernstein should not have used the silent confirm or hang up method with the Justice Department lawyer. The instructions were too complicated. Indeed, they learned the attorney had gotten the instructions backward and had meant to warn them off the story. With Deep Throat, Woodward had placed too much faith in a code for confirmation, instead of accepting only a clear statement. The next afternoon, October 26th, several hours after Henry Kissinger met with the press in the White House to declare that peace is at hand in Southeast Asia, Clark McGregor entered the Washington studios of the National Public Affairs Center for Television to be interviewed. From the administration's point of view, it was a perfect opportunity to adjust its public posture to hard realities and correct some of the misstatements that might haunt the White House later, particularly since anything McGregor said would be overshadowed by Kissinger's announcement. McGregor confirmed the existence of a CRP cash fund for clandestine activities, though he quarreled with the term secret and insisted that disbursements from the fund had not knowingly been spent for illegal activities. He maintained that the money in Stanza's safe had been used to determine if there were organized efforts to sabotage Nixon's primary campaign. He named five persons who had authorized or received payments: Mitchell, Stans, Magruder, Porter, and Liddy. McGregor's remarks seemed to salvage some of the credibility the reporters had lost in the Haldeman debacle. The day before, Ziegler had denied the fund's existence. Bradley ruled it off page one, which already had another Watergate story. "That'd look like we're grinding it in on their day of peace at hand," Bradley told Woodward, who had been lobbying for the front page. The New York Times put the McGregor story on page one, adding a significant fact. Sworn testimony by individuals connected with the Nixon committee, the Times reported, showed that cash disbursements of $900,000 had been made from the fund. That morning, Woodward had moved the red-flagged flower pot on his balcony. He knew this would be the grimmest meeting ever with Deep Throat. When he got home at about 9 p.m., Woodward made himself an Ovaltine milkshake and fell asleep reading. He didn't awaken until 1:30 a.m. Angry at being late, he considered driving, then rejected the idea as too risky. He and Bernstein had already been incautious once too often. Woodward put on warm clothes and dashed down the back stairs and into the alley. He walked 15 blocks, found a cab, and made it to the parking garage shortly before 3 a.m. Deep Throat was waiting in a dark corner, huddled against the wall. The reporters needed help badly, Woodward told him, then spilled out all of his feelings of uncertainty, confusion, regret, and anger. He talked for 15 or 20 minutes. Deep Throat asked an occasional question and appeared to be deeply concerned, more sad than remorseful. Woodward wanted him to know how desperate their situation was. The mistake had jeopardized all of their earlier reporting, he believed. The stories had been building. Eventually the White House would have had to yield. Now the pressure was off the White House, because the burden of proof had shifted back to the Post. "Well, Haldeman slipped away from you," Deep Throat stated. He kicked his heel at the garage wall, making no attempt to hide his disappointment. The entire story would never become known now. The Haldeman error had sealed the lid. Deep Throat moved closer to Woodward. "Let me explain something," he said. "When you move on somebody like Haldeman, you gotta be sure you're on the most solid ground." "Shit, what a royal screw-up." He stepped even closer, speaking in a whisper. "I'm probably not telling you anything you don't know, but your essential facts are right. From top to bottom, this whole business is a Haldeman operation. He ran the money, insulated himself through those functionaries around him. Now, how do you get at it?" Deep Throat described the Haldeman operation. "This guy is bright and can be smooth when necessary, but most of the time he's not smooth. He is assistant president, and everyone has access to him if they want to take it. He sends out the orders. He can be very nasty about it." Haldeman had four principal assistants to whom he delegated orders but not responsibility. Lawrence Higby, a young punk nobody who does what he's told. Chapin, smarter and more urbane than Higby, also a dedicated yes-man. Strachan, soldierly and capable. And Alexander Butterfield, an ex-Air Force colonel who knows how to push paper and people. "Everybody goes chicken after you make a mistake like you guys made," Deep Throat continued. "It contributes to the myth of Haldeman invincibility, adds to the fortress. It looks like he really stuck it in your eye, secretly pulling the strings to get even the Washington Post to fuck it up." The story had been the worst possible setback. "You've got people feeling sorry for Haldeman. I didn't think that was possible." Deep Throat stamped his foot. "A conspiracy like this, a conspiracy investigation, the rope has to tighten slowly around everyone's neck. You build convincingly from the outer edges in. You get 10 times the evidence you need against the Hunts and Liddies. They feel hopelessly finished. They may not talk right away, but the grip is on them. Then you move up and do the same thing at the next level. If you shoot too high and miss, then everybody feels more secure. Lawyers work this way. I'm sure smart reporters must, too. You put the investigation back months. It puts everyone on the defensive. Editors, FBI agents, everybody has to go into a crouch after this." Woodward swallowed hard. He deserved the lecture. That afternoon, Woodward told Bernstein what Deep Throat had said. They agreed they should write a story saying that Haldeman had not been named by Sloan before the grand jury, but reasserting that reliable sources had again confirmed Haldeman's authority over the secret fund. Bradley and the other editors didn't want the story. The fires were cooling. They didn't want to fan them. Sunday, Senator McGovern appeared on NBC's Meet the Press and welcomed the opportunity to drive home his Watergate message.
It was all true, McGovern said, because two respected reporters from the Washington Post had said so.
The same afternoon, Spiro Agnew on ABC's Issues and Answers offered a different opinion.
Journalistically reprehensible, he said of the Post's coverage in general, and described the Haldeman account as a contrived story constructed out of two untruths, attempting to tie this to the president.
Minutes after the shows, Simons was on the phone to Rosenfeld. The paper now had no choice but to correct the Haldeman story. It was intolerable to have the Democratic presidential candidate running around the country quoting inaccurate information from the Washington Post. Bernstein and Woodward were told to write an account clarifying the controversy. They were sitting by Bernstein's desk when a wire room attendant brought them a press release from Time magazine. The release stated that Time had obtained information from FBI files showing that Dwight Chapin had admitted to FBI agents that he had hired Donald Segretti to disrupt the Democratic campaign. That Chapin had also told the FBI that Segretti's payment was set by Nixon's personal attorney, California lawyer Herbert Kalmbach, and that the president's personal lawyer had also admitted making the payments to Segretti. But, Time's account continued, no hard evidence could be developed to support a charge by the Washington Post that H.R. Haldeman, the White House chief of staff, was one of those with control over a fund that paid for spying and disruption. Woodward and Bernstein were aware that Time's access to FBI files was unquestioned. They wrote a routine account that led with Time's Chapin-Kalmbach information and the magazine's conclusion on Haldeman. Then the story said that Sloan had been asked by the Post if Haldeman was one of those authorized to approve payments from the fund, even if Sloan had not imparted such information to the grand jury. The story quoted Sloan as saying our denial was strictly limited and added, "The Post reporters then went back to their federal sources and were told that the Post story was incorrect in identifying Sloan's grand jury testimony as the source of information on Haldeman's link to the fund. However, these same sources, who have provided detailed information on the Watergate investigation, confirmed once more that Haldeman was authorized to make payments from the fund. One source went so far as to say, this is a Haldeman operation, and that Haldeman had insulated himself, dealing with the fund through an intermediary. Chapter 10. For some weeks, Bernstein and Woodward had been looking forward to Election Day. The final stretch of the campaign was the most frustrating period they had encountered since June 17th. In addition to the Haldeman debacle, they had begun to run into one stone wall after another. After the self-congratulations and enthusiasms generated by the initial accounts of Segretti's operations and the Chapin-Kalmbach connections, the Post had mounted a huge investigation under Sussman's command. More than a dozen reporters were intermittently involved, investigating, analyzing the political fallout, writing profiles of the central figures, following the action in the courts, on Capitol Hill, at the White House. Little new information was developed. A few more Segretti contacts, isolated incidents of sabotage by the Nixon forces, additional examples of the narrowness of the course pursued by the FBI and federal prosecutors. Bernstein and Woodward had resumed their evening visits. Nothing. The election was too near. Several people suggested they might be more talkative after Nixon's victory. The promise of easier access to information after November 7th was not the only reason the reporters wanted the election behind them. With Nixon's re-election, the White House would be forced to abandon the line that the Post was working for the election of McGovern. Woodward spent Election Day idly at the office, sometimes watching Sussman indulge his fascination with polling. Puffing his pipe, Sussman was trying to see if there were any way the polls could be wrong, calculating that if George McGovern were to win, it would entail a shift of so many million votes. The latest surveys were strewn around.
scrap paper remnants of long division, multiplication, additions, and symbols understandable only to Sussman. He concluded that it was mathematically impossible for Richard Nixon to lose. Woodward, a registered Republican, didn't vote. He couldn't decide whether he was more uneasy with the disorganization and naive idealism of McGovern's campaign or with Richard Nixon's conduct. And he believed that not voting enabled him to be more objective in reporting on Watergate, a view Bernstein regarded as silly. Bernstein voted for McGovern, unenthusiastically and unhesitatingly, then bet in the office pool that Nixon would win by 54%. Nixon won the election with 61% of the vote. The day after the election, Bradley and Simons asked Sussman for a memo advising how Bernstein and Woodward intended to pursue their investigations and listing areas on which they intended to concentrate. Sussman told the reporters he detected a lot of pressure for a story. Any story, as long as it was good. Something that would take the heat off the Post and put away the notion that the paper had been promoting George McGovern's campaign. Woodward was demonstrably angered at the request. Not without a touch of arrogance, Bernstein and he advised Sussman to write a memo for the editors saying any damn thing that came into his head. Sussman wrote a one-page memo which concluded, "Woodward and Bernstein are going back to virtually every old source, and some new ones, who have shown an interest in talking now that the election is over. Some of our best stories to date were pretty much unexpected, and did not come from particular lines of inquiry, and quite possibly the same will be true now." At 5 on the morning of November 11th, a Post switchboard operator tracked down Bernstein at the home of a friend. She said she had been calling all over town for him since midnight. "Great," said Bernstein, and wondered loudly how the operator had found him and whom else she had called to do so. "We don't disclose our sources of information, dear," she replied. He was to call Sussman at home immediately. Bernstein had received middle-of-the-night calls from the office before. Usually they signaled calamity or tragedy. Robert Kennedy's assassination, bombings at the Pentagon, the Capitol. Sussman answered the phone. "Segretti's back home. Bob Meyer spoke with him very briefly." Sussman wanted Bernstein to get the next plane to Los Angeles and talk to Segretti, if he would talk. Segretti had disappeared immediately after the October 10th story. Bernstein reached Dulles Airport 5 minutes before the flight with less than $20 in his wallet. Myers met Bernstein at the Los Angeles airport, and they drove immediately to Segretti's apartment in Marina del Rey, about 20 minutes away. He wasn't home, so Myers stuck one more matchstick on the door. Bernstein reached Segretti by phone late that afternoon. "Hi, Carl," he answered. "I wondered when we'd meet up with each other." His tone was cheerful and chipper, but not flip. He agreed to let Bernstein and Myers come over. "I won't discuss any specifics, and everything has to be off the record." Segretti was dressed in corduroy jeans and Scandinavian sweater, and had a grin on his face when they arrived. He shook hands with Bernstein warmly. "How've you been?" he asked. Bernstein was struck by the fact that he was only 5'4". This was the master spy? Secret agent with a White House badge? Segretti had a baby face, a slightly toothy smile, and traces of a cowlick. Segretti invited Bernstein and Myers to sit down on the living room couch and chatted about his hi-fi equipment. "The fact is that I'm about broke," he said after a while. "Out of a job, and I still have payments on the car, and there'll be legal fees." Segretti was, by his own account, confused, scared, angry, and without friends. Bernstein found him likable, and his situation pathetic. "I really want to tell the whole story and get this thing over with," Segretti said. "I don't understand how I got in over my head. I didn't know what it was all about. They never told me anything except my own role. I had to read the papers to find out." "They?" "The White House." Segretti was agitated about the inquiries made to his family, friends, and acquaintances by the press, and by the investigators from Senator Edward Kennedy's subcommittee. 2 days after the Post's October 10th story, Senator Kennedy directed his subcommittee on administrative practice and procedure to open an investigation into the allegations of White House-sponsored sabotage and spying. "Kennedy is out for blood, and I'm the one treading water and bleeding," Segretti said. "Kennedy will tear me to shreds." Some people even asked my friends if I knew Arthur Bremmer. Arthur Bremmer was the man who had attempted to assassinate Governor George Wallace of Alabama. Segretti's eyes filled with tears. "How could anybody even ask something like that? It's terrible. It's horrible. I didn't do anything to deserve that. What do people think I am? If that's the kind of thing Kennedy gets into, that might just be the point where I say fuck the whole thing and get up and walk out and let him put me in jail. I've been dragged through the mud, maligned. You'd think I was making bombs or something. I haven't done anything illegal, or even that bad. My friends have been harassed, my parents, my girlfriends. My privacy has been invaded. My phone is tapped, it clicks all the time. People have been following me. Everybody I ever telephoned has been bothered." Segretti's naivete was compelling. He traced most of his difficulties to the press. He was particularly angry with the New York Times and Newsweek for getting his phone records and badgering his family. So Myers and Bernstein calculatedly dumped on the opposition. The process was excruciatingly slow. Segretti wouldn't volunteer any information without prodding, and refused to discuss his activities except in general terms. "What I did was mostly nickel-dime stuff," he said. "Maybe 15 cents, or a quarter every once in a while." Finally, Segretti admitted he had been hired by Chapin. Strachan also had discussed the job with him. Kalmbach had paid him. The first approach had been from Dwight Chapin to Segretti, not vice versa. "I didn't go looking for the job," Segretti said bitterly. "What would you do if you were just getting out of the army, if you had been away from the real world for 4 years? You didn't know what kind of law you wanted to practice, and you got a call to go to work for the President of the United States." "If the really sinister things actually happened, I don't think Dwight knew about them," Segretti said. "Dwight just did what he was told."
"Told by whom?"
"Well, I'd sure like to meet Haldeman," he suggested. Did Segretti have any hard evidence that it was Haldeman? Had Chapin ever said so? "No. But I understand that Dwight generally takes his orders on everything from Haldeman." Segretti confirmed meeting Howard Hunt and a man he thought was Gordon Liddy in Miami. Hunt had asked him to organize an anti-Nixon demonstration to embarrass McGovern. He wouldn't say what the plan was, but it sounded illegal to me, and I didn't want anything to do with being violent or breaking the law. After each visit from the FBI, Segretti acknowledged, he had called Chapin for advice, but he wouldn't say who had counseled him just before his grand jury appearance. He denied that his testimony had been prompted or rehearsed, or that he had been shown FBI reports. "That's an example of some of the lies and bullshit that have been written," he said. "That would be as bad as the Watergate bugging." He had discussed his upcoming testimony with someone from the White House. They had agreed that every question asked by the grand jury would be answered truthfully. Bernstein got the impression that the discussion had been with John Dean. Segretti said he had been interviewed for what he presumed was the Dean investigation, but he wouldn't say whether the interview had been conducted by Dean himself or a member of his staff, or whether it had occurred immediately prior to the grand jury appearance. "I won't discuss John Dean," he said. And he would not say whether he had ever met him. Segretti said he was through being a pawn of the White House. "They're going to have to break down my door and drag me to get me out of here again. All I want is to get my life back in order. I think the lowest point was when the mother of an old girlfriend told me she didn't want her daughter to see me anymore. People can really be cruel." Again, Segretti's eyes glazed over and filled with tears. "Everyone is out to rip me apart and crucify me. Kennedy, the White House, the press.
I just want to stay here and enjoy myself for a while. Sail, swim, sit in the sun, see some girls.
During the visit, which lasted several hours, Segretti seemed as interested in finding out what Bernstein knew as Bernstein was interested in what he knew. There would be more to come, Bernstein said. None too subtly, he warned Segretti that he could expect to get swallowed up if he didn't get his story on the record soon. Unlike his superiors, he had no cloak of high office for protection. Segretti agreed, but he wanted more time. They would talk again the next day. Bernstein called the office from his motel. Woodward, Sussman, Rosenfeld, and Bradley were all hanging on extensions. "Get it on the record, for Christ's sake," Bradley said. There was enough in the scant information Segretti had offered to seriously challenge White House claims of innocence. Bernstein spent 5 more days in Marina del Rey, persuading his colleagues at the Post and himself that Segretti was going to convert and go on the record. But it was no go.
"Well, kid, we struck out on that one," was Bradley's reply when Bernstein returned to the office. Bernstein had typed a 12-page, single-spaced memo detailing every aspect of his dealings with Segretti. Bradley had scanned the memo and made an open-fisted gesture, jerking his arm. "Quit beating yourself off, kid," he told Bernstein, "and get some information."
Bradley's frustration was understandable. The election had not stilled the White House guns. The self-confidence that flowed from the electoral triumph had emboldened the president's men. The post-election offensive was led by Charles Wendell Colson, the 41-year-old former Marine Corps captain and a White House commandant on political warfare. About a week after the election, Colson traveled to Kennebunkport, Maine, very near Edmund Muskie's summer home, to address the New England Society of Newspaper Editors. He opened the speech by noting that his home state, Massachusetts, was the only one that had gone for George McGovern. The president, he joked, had decided to mend some fences and locate a new federal installation in Massachusetts, a nuclear waste disposal center in Harvard Square. Assuring his audience that the First Amendment is alive and well in Washington, he accused the Post of McCarthyism and called Bradley the self-appointed leader of what Boston's Teddy White, Theodore H. White, author of The Making of the President series, once described as that tiny little fringe of arrogant elitists who affect the healthy mainstream of American journalism with their own peculiar view of the world. If Bradley ever left the Georgetown cocktail circuit, where he and his pals dine on third-hand information and gossip and rumor, he might discover out here the real America. And he might learn that all truth and all knowledge and all superior wisdom just doesn't emanate exclusively from that small little clique in Georgetown. And that the rest of the country isn't just sitting out here waiting to be told what they're supposed to think. Bradley read Colson's speech in his office and walked over to Woodward's desk.
"They're really kicking it at me," he said. "That's some pretty personal shit."
Woodward thought he was ruffled.
"I know it's there," Bradley said.
Woodward recognized an admonition to dig harder.
"I know it's there," Bradley repeated.
Later, Bradley told an interviewer that he'd been ready to hold both Woodward and Bernstein's heads in a pail of water until they came up with another story. That dry spell was anguish. Anguish. In the 4 weeks following the election, the reporters went chasing around as if their heads were in a pail of water. They were learning things, but were unable to make any meaningful stories out of what information they got. Magruder's secretary told Bernstein she didn't understand why she hadn't been interviewed by the FBI. John Dean had sat in on all the FBI interviews with White House personnel, a Justice Department attorney said, and the prosecutors were upset about it. Dean had also received copies of the FBI reports for the Watergate investigation. A secretary at the Mullen firm told Woodward that Dorothy Hunt, wife of Howard Hunt, was saying that Howard is being made a scapegoat. A middle echelon White House aide said, "Dwight Chapin walks around as if he's just packed his bags." and the big election victory seemed muted, other White House aides were saying, and Watergate was number one priority with the president, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Colson. Some presidential aides who were normally insiders were saying they didn't know what was going on. There were discussions in the White House of releasing a report on Watergate, a white paper to lay out the facts, but it had been discarded as too risky. A prominent Washington lawyer who had high political connections told Woodward, "I understand that someone is taking care of Hunt and McCord, either through CRP or the White House. Someone from the White House got to Judge Ritchie through the back door and got him to help the administration." A Republican governor said he could get to Ritchie, and word came back that there was no need. It had already been done. Dean, Mitchell, and Haldeman all later testified that a Washington lawyer, Romer McPhee, had engaged in private discussions about the civil case with Judge Ritchie. Dean testified that McPhee initiated private discussions with the judge to seek favorable treatment for the administration in the civil suit. Mitchell acknowledged that he had had at least 9 meetings during the summer of 1972 with McPhee, who has been a personal friend of Ritchie's for many years. However, Mitchell said it was inconceivable that McPhee had approached the judge improperly. Judge Ritchie flatly denied any improper conduct and said that he and McPhee had never discussed any substantive aspects of the case. A close friend of John Mitchell's described the former attorney general as essentially a very decent man who didn't have any use for the kind of Mickey Mouse stuff that Haldeman and Colson and the others were dreaming up. One of the president's former top aides argued that Haldeman would have been delinquent if he had not set up a procedure to gather political intelligence for the president. A ranking Justice Department official observed, "From what I hear, some of my best friends should be in jail." At least a dozen people said that Jeb Magruder was finished and would not get an administration job that required Senate confirmation. An assistant attorney general was convinced that the Dean investigation was a fraud, a pipeline to Haldeman. Mrs. Graham was told by a close friend who had ties to the administration that the phones of several Post reporters and news executives were tapped. A sweep, which was conducted by electronics experts for a fee of $5,000, turned up nothing. The government had inexplicably failed to execute search warrants for the homes of the 5 arrested burglars. A former Internal Revenue Service official related keen White House interest in some tax investigations of the president's friends. "Nothing I could put my finger on fully, but the message was coming over." Disillusioned campaign workers at CRP referred to a cover story that had been told to the prosecutors. Hunt and Liddy had been members of the Plumbers, a secret White House team investigating leaks to the news media. The White House had no comment in the summer when Time magazine said there was such a group. One late November Saturday night, a Post editor asked for a word with Woodward in a deserted section of the newsroom. One of his neighbors had told him that his aunt was on a grand jury. His neighbor thought it was the jury on Watergate. She'd made some remark about knowing all about it. "She's a Republican, but she says she really hates Nixon now. My neighbor thinks she wants to talk." A few days later, the editor handed Woodward a slip of paper with the woman's name and address. Bernstein and Woodward went to Rosenfeld, who seemed to like the idea of a visit, but suspended final judgment until he had checked with Bradley for a policy decision. Bradley asked the Post's lawyers. Bernstein and Woodward consulted the Post's library copy of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Grand jurors took an oath to keep secret their deliberations and the testimony before them. But the burden of secrecy, it appeared, was on the juror. There seemed to be nothing in the law that forbade anyone to ask questions. The lawyers agreed, but urged extreme caution in making any approaches. They recommended that the reporter simply ask the woman if she wanted to talk. Bradley was nervous. "No beating anyone over the head, no pressure, none of that cajoling," he instructed Woodward and Bernstein. He got up from behind his desk and pointed his finger. "I'm serious about that. Particularly you, Bernstein. Be subtle, for once in your life." He instructed them to get in touch with him the moment the visit was over. Get to a phone booth and call me, no matter what happens. They drove over to her house. She wasn't there. Woodward called Sussman at the office and asked him to pass the word to Bradley. The next morning, the reporters drove across town, knocked at the woman's door, and identified themselves. She invited them inside. They did not mention the grand jury, and said simply that they had heard she knew something about Watergate.
"It's a mess, I know that," the woman said. "But how would I know anything about it except for what I read in the papers?"
It took 10 minutes to figure out that the woman was indeed on a grand jury at the courthouse, but not the Watergate one. They thanked her and left. The episode had whetted their interest. They knew the outlines of the information they needed. They lacked the details a cooperative grand juror could probably supply. That afternoon, Bernstein called the chief prosecutor, Earl Silbert, and asked for a list of the 23 grand jurors. Silbert refused flatly, rejecting Bernstein's contention that the membership of the jury was a matter of public record. Woodward asked a friend in the clerk's office if it was possible to get a roster of the Watergate grand jury. "No way whatsoever," he was told. "The record's a secret." Next morning, Woodward took a cab to the courthouse. The clerk's office employed about 90 people. Woodward started at one end of the large complex of file rooms, and after half an hour had found someone willing to direct him to a remote corner of the main file area where lists of trial and grand juries were kept. He identified himself to another clerk as a post reporter and said he wanted to look through the file. The clerk looked at Woodward suspiciously. "Okay," he said, "but you aren't allowed to copy anything. You can't take names. No notes. I'll be watching." Woodward started going through the file drawers and finally found the master list of 1972 grand juries. Two grand juries had been sworn in on June 5th. He remembered that the foreman of the Watergate grand jury had an Eastern European name and worked for the government as an economist or something like that. He found the right name on grand jury number 1, sworn in on June 5th, 1972. Each of the grand jurors had filled out a small orange card listing name, age, occupation, address, home, and work telephones. Woodward began sifting through the cards, then glanced over his shoulder. The clerk was sitting at his desk about 15 feet away, staring at him. Woodward took the first 4 cards, set them face up in the bottom of the file drawer, and began studying the names, ages, addresses, phone numbers, and occupations. It took about 10 minutes to memorize the information. He asked the clerk where the men's room was. Inside the washroom, Woodward went into a stall, took a notebook from his jacket pocket, and wrote out what he had memorized. Priscilla L. Woodruff, age 28, unemployed. Trying to visualize what each of the grand jurors looked like helped him keep track of the information. Naomi R. Williams, 56, retired teacher and elevator operator. Julian L. White, 37, janitor at George Washington University. Woodward drew a mental picture of a coat of arms and the name of Haldeman etched beneath a pair of cross daggers guarding a throne. George W. Stockton, he wrote in his notebook. Institute of Heraldry, Department of the Army, technician, age 53. He hitched up his trousers. 4 down, 19 to go. Woodward memorized the next 5 cards. Straining not to look guilty, he asked the clerk where the chief judge's chambers were. The man frowned. "You're sure spending a lot of time with those files. I'm not so sure that you're allowed to even look in there." Woodward said he'd be back, as soon as he had checked something with the chief judge. Upstairs in a 3rd-floor washroom, he wrote down the 5 names and the other information. That left 14. At the rate he was going, the job would take all morning. On the 3rd try, he was able to memorize 6 cards. Returning from the lavatory to the file room, he asked the clerk when he went to lunch. "I don't go out for lunch," the man said curtly. The perfect clerk, Woodward thought ruefully, even eats at his desk. He needed to get the rest this time, because the clerk was getting impatient. It took nearly 45 minutes to memorize the last 8 names and accompanying details. At the office, he typed a list of the jury members and the accompanying data. In Bradley's office, the editors and Bernstein and Woodward eliminated nearly half the members of the grand jury as too risky. Low-grade civil servants, especially older ones, for instance, were accustomed to doing things by the bureaucratic book, checking with their superiors, rarely relying on their own judgment. Military officers the same. They were looking for the few least likely to inform the prosecutors of a visit. The candidate would have to be bright enough to suspect that the grand jury system had broken down in the Watergate case, and be in command of the nuances of the evidence. Ideally, the juror would be capable of outrage at the White House or the prosecutors or both. A person who was accustomed to bending the rules. The type of person who valued practicality more than procedure. The exercise continued with Bernstein, Woodward, and their bosses trying to psych out strangers on the basis of name, address, age, occupation, ethnic background, religion, income level. The final choices were left to the reporters. Everyone in the room had private doubts about such a seedy venture. Bradley, desperate for a story and reassured by the lawyers, overcame his own. Simons doubted out loud the rightness of the exercise and worried about the paper. Rosenfeld was concerned most about the mechanics of the reporters not getting caught. Sussman was afraid that one of them, probably Bernstein, would push too hard and find a way to violate the law. Woodward wondered whether there was ever justification for a reporter to entice someone across the line of legality while standing safely on the right side himself. Bernstein, who vaguely approved of selective civil disobedience, was not concerned about breaking the law in the abstract. It was a question of which law, and he believed that grand jury proceedings should be inviolate. The misgivings, however, went unstated for the most part. The reporter's procedure would be to identify themselves, tell the juror that they had learned from an anonymous mutual acquaintance that he or she knew something about Watergate, and ask if he or she was willing to discuss the matter. They would leave unless the juror, without prodding, volunteered something. Nothing would be said about the grand jury unless the juror mentioned it. Bradley, addressing them in a final briefing before bivouac, repeated the marching orders. No strong-arm tactics, fellas, right? Working separately over the first weekend of December, Woodward and Bernstein attempted the clumsy charade with about half a dozen members of the grand jury. They returned with no information, and a clear impression that the prosecutors had warned the jurors to beware of jokers wearing press cards. Only one person volunteered that he was on the grand jury, and he explained to Woodward that he had taken 2 oaths of secrecy in his life, the Elks and the grand jurors, and that both were sacred trusts. The others said they didn't know anything about Watergate except what they had learned from the media. One told Bernstein, "Watergate? Oh, yeah, that fancy apartment down in Foggy Bottom. I heard about it on the television, all that break-in business and stuff. There's no place safe in this city." Until he heard about the Elk, Bernstein had feared that his partner with a fantastic memory had wasted it on the wrong list. On Monday, Bradley called the reporters into his office for an urgent meeting. He shut the door, a gesture often reserved for such delicate matters of state as firings. "The balloon is up," he said. At least one of the grand jurors had told the prosecutors he'd been visited by a Washington Post reporter. One of the prosecutors had called Edward Bennett Williams, the Post's principal attorney. The prosecutors had gone to Judge Sirica with the juror's complaint, and Williams had advised Bradley to have his reporters sit tight. They asked Bradley how much trouble Williams thought they were in. "You're not going to get an award," said Bradley. Williams said that it's up to the judge. But he was worried. John Sirica, the chief judge of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, was known as Maximum John because of the stiff punishments he imposed. Late in the afternoon, Bradley told the reporters to be in Williams' office at 9 the next morning. "Things look a little better," he said.
Williams talked to Sirica and to the prosecutors. He thinks he can keep you out of the slam. The next morning, Williams was pacing around his handsome office.
John Sirica is some kind of pissed off at you fellas, he said. We had to do a lot of convincing to keep your asses out of jail.
Williams pledged there would be no more post-contact with grand jury members. The prosecutors, too, had interceded in the reporter's behalf, recommending to Sirica that no action be taken because none of the grand jurors had imparted any information. But Sirica was still fuming, Williams said, and would probably lecture them at a minimum.
Stay in touch and keep your noses clean, he warned. The judge could be very unpredictable.
The reporters returned to more conventional sources. A few nights later, Bernstein signed a post car out of the office garage and drove to an apartment several miles away. It was about 8 o'clock when he knocked on the door. The woman he was looking for answered, but when he told her his name, she didn't open the door. She slipped a piece of paper underneath it with her unlisted telephone number written on it. "Call me later this evening," she said, adding, "Your articles have been excellent." The woman was in a position to have considerable knowledge of the secret activities of the White House and CRP. Bernstein had attempted to contact her before, but she had rejected every approach. He drove back to the office and dialed the number. Her voice was unsteady, nervous.
"At this point, I don't trust a soul," she said, "but I respect your position."
She asked if Bernstein was calling from a safe phone. He was at the desk of a reporter on the Maryland staff. He thought so.
"I'm forced to agree 100% with Ben Bradley. The truth hasn't been told," she said.
Bernstein printed the letter Z on the top sheet of a blue memo pad. X had been retired with the bookkeeper.
"My boss calls it a whitewash," said Z. "2 years ago, I never would have believed any of this, but the facts are overwhelming."
She advised him to reread carefully the reporter's own stories.
"There's more truth in there than you must have realized. Many clues. You're doing very well, but you could do a lot better. It's a question of putting on more pressure."
She refused to be interrogated and laid down the ground rules. She would point the reporters in the right direction to help them fill in some of the right names in the right places, certain hints, key avenues to pursue. She would answer questions only in the most general way, if at all. Much of what she called her message might seem vague, partly because even she didn't understand things completely, and because the information would be difficult to sort out.
"Your perseverance has been admirable," she said. "Apply it to what I say."
Bernstein, who had no idea what to expect, thought she sounded like some kind of mystic. She began with Haldeman.
"Someone had to pull the strings. You have a lot of company in thinking it's Haldeman. John Dean is very interesting. It would be really interesting to know what Dean's investigation really was. His involvement went way beyond that. Magruder and Mitchell are very definitely involved. Mitchell requires more perseverance."
Bernstein had already interrupted her several times, but she would not be more specific.
"Involved in what? Dirty tricks? Wiretapping?"
She advised him to consider Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, and Mardian as a group.
"Disclosure is the common thread," she said. "Yes, of wiretap information."
"Meaning they had received information from the Watergate tap?"
"Disclosure," she repeated, "is the common thread. When people have jobs to lose in high places, they will go to any extent to protect them. The general theme is, don't blow the lid, even now. They're better organized now than before June 17th. They are good organizers, but, to a certain extent, very sloppy. Financing is the most important way to learn who is involved. Pursue other Segrettis. Kalmbach was the paymaster. A lot of activities grew out of plumbing. It goes back a lot farther than the Pentagon Papers. The plumbers are quite relevant. Two of them were indicted. I'd like to know how many more plumbers there were."
Bernstein tried to learn more. Z said there would be no further messages. He was forbidden to call her.
The next night, Woodward and Bernstein drove the familiar route to Hugh Sloan's house. Perhaps he could help decipher Z's message. Knowing that